shotgun or what? I stood there in the wind, the blowing snow peppering the side of my face with its sting as I looked into my truck. The rifle was there, a palpable reminder of things I could not see, and beside it sat a black and white box of ammunition for things I could. Vic must have left the box after the tests. A little joke, or maybe she thought I might need it. I wondered mildly what had happened to the Weatherby I had on the mountain, or to the Remington that Henry had been carrying. Was anybody in there? Ever since the mountain, I was careful to look for them out of the corners of my eyes. It seemed as though if I stood there long enough, they would begin to appear, sitting easily on the leather seats, and looking back at me with their hair-bone chokers, their trade cloth tied in their hair, and their closed-mouth smiles. They held the rifle in their laps, waiting for me to get in so they could hand it to me. I leaned against the door and closed my eyes. The glass was cold, but I could think again. I opened my eyes, and they were gone. I stood there for another moment. And I'm not sure if I was making sure they were gone or hoping they would reappear. I turned the key, opened the door, and slid in next to the Cheyenne rifle of the dead. My hand shook a little as I slid the rifle over and placed the box of ammunition on the seat next to me. The box looked old, as if the edges had been roughed off and the printing had been done by an antiquated press. The date on the box even read 1876. It felt heavy, and I thought about pumpkins. By the time I got over to my desk, the Espers were waiting on line two. I had told Ruby I would get it in my office and passed by Vic's open door. She was on the phone, and it looked like she was enjoying her call far more than I would mine. It was probably her friends at the Department of Justice, and I had a brief twinge of panicked jealousy. If Vic weren't married to Wyoming anymore, she'd be a fool not to go back east and get a job with a large urban department or with the feds. As I sat there in my office, my plans for the first female Wyoming sheriff evaporated into thin, high plains air. I picked up the receiver and punched line two. Longmire. I sounded busy and possibly a little angry. Sheriff? It was Reggie Esper. Yeah, Reggie, are you still in Deadwood? There was a pause. We are. I told the mine I'd be back yesterday, but we had a lucky streak and decided to stay on till Monday. Then this South Dakota highway patrolman came to the casino and got us. Another pause. Walt, if this is about that damn Pritchard kid, I haven't let the boys have anything to do with him.
It's not about Cody Pritchard.
Yet another pause. Well, is it important? I mean, I don't want to cut a weekend short if I...
It's important.
I stared at the blotter on my desk and picked up a pen. I looked up at the old Seth Thomas clock on my wall, a plugged-in leftover from Lucian and Red Angus before him. I adjusted it twice a year, and it never lost or gained a second. It's a little after 11, and you could be here by 3 or so. There was a discussion going on in the background. We'll leave right after lunch. He started to hang up. Reggie, make sure you come straight to the sheriff's office. He said he would. I put the phone back, leaned an elbow on my desk, and accidentally hit my ear. I swore and readjusted my hand to my cheek. It hurt to hold the pen, and I clutched my tender fingers in a half claw. I put the Espers down for 4 o'clock and wrote a note to ask Vic about ballistics. I had to talk to the curator of firearms at the Buffalo Bill Museum in Cody, talk to Jim Keller, and call Dave at the sports shop about Vasque's size 9s. I was also beginning to wonder about Lucian and Turk. I started to punch the intercom on my phone, but all the lines were busy. Probably Vic faxing her resume. I got up and walked out to Ruby's desk. She was on the phone, too, but she hung up. Lonnie Littlebird was here looking for you. She laced her fingers together and rested her chin on them. He's sweet.
Yes, he is.
I paused for a second. I've got the Espers coming in this afternoon. If they're running late, can you stick around? Yes. Anything on Jim Keller?
not back from Nebraska yet, but Mrs. Keller has been here twice already today.
How's the kid doing?
He's in the back, asleep. I gave him the old sheriff report books to look at, which would put anybody to sleep. By the way, you have the worst penmanship of any sheriff we've ever had since 1881. I thought you'd be glad to know.
Who was before 1881?
She raised an eyebrow. Nobody. That's when we first became a county in the territory, about 9 years before we became a state. You did hear about that?
I scratched at my ear and immediately regretted it.
Yep.
I remember reading about it in the papers.
Stop picking at your ear.
Yes, ma'am. I slouched a little bit.
Do you know what's happened to Lucian and Turk?
They are having lunch down the hill at the Busy Bee. Lucian mentioned something about having a come-to-Jesus meeting with his nephew.
Oh, boy. Anything from Vic on the ballistics at DCI?
Why don't you ask her?
She's on the phone. I looked down at all the blinking lights on Ruby's console. She's on all of them.
Then she hasn't, or she is now.
She stayed looking at me. We're not going to be able to keep her, are we? It was out before I knew I had said it, and when I looked up, Ruby's electric blues steadfastly joined with mine.
Why don't you go have lunch? She'll be off the phones by the time you get back. Besides, you could use a little religion.
In its usual perverse manner, the sun had decided to come out and cast a glare without providing any heat. It might get warmer by the end of the afternoon, but for now it was just plain cold. As I navigated the courthouse steps, I looked up at Vern's window. He was probably up there still waiting for our lunch. But I could bet that he wouldn't want anything to do with Lucian's type of revival meeting, even though I was sure it would carry its own unique version of fire and brimstone. Cody and Jacob, convicted of 2 counts of first-degree sexual assault, could have been sentenced to as much as 40 years. The sentencing date hung over all of us for 2 solid weeks, but over nobody as much as Vern Selby. The jury had lived with deciding, and now they had passed it on to Vern like some communicable disease, and the fever of justice ate away at him. He had taken it upon himself to merge the 2 counts into 1, which was his judicial latitude, and sentenced Cody and Jacob to a maximum of 15 years in prison, far to the low side of the 5 to 50 year sentencing guideline. George had gotten the minimum of 10, but it all became academic when the judge had pronounced that the offenders would be incarcerated in a young adult institution in Casper, and would therefore receive indeterminate terms. I guess Vern had decided that since they were all first offenders, the rape shouldn't cost them the rest of their lives. Never mind what it had cost Melissa. Cody Pritchard had turned to his friends in the back of the courtroom and playfully tossed his hat in the air and smiled. With time off for good behavior, Cody, Jacob, and George could see less than 2 years of soft prison time. Brian Keller would receive 2 years of probation and 100 hours of community service. The young men were once again released without bail, and Vern had nodded quietly in his chambers when I personally volunteered to drive the 3 of them down to Casper. When I got to the Busy Bee, I glanced through the window. Turk was slouched on his stool and was against the wall about as far as he could be. Lucian, with his lips barely moving, was leaning in and glared at the side of Turk's face. Any thoughts of hunger passed, and I continued along the sidewalk to the sports shop. When I went in, David was punching something into his computer behind the counter, and his wife, Sue, was waiting on an overweight, middle-aged woman in the shoe department. I strolled up to the counter and leaned a hip against it. He looked up through the top of his bifocals. "Hi, Walt. What's the number one selling hiking boot?"
"Here?" he thought. "Vask? Maybe Oslo?"
"Most popular size?"
9, maybe 10.
"Any way to track how many Vasks, size 9s, you've sold in the last year or so?" He looked at me and sighed.
"You're lucky Sue's here today. I don't have time for..."
"Make time."
I looked at him for a moment to reinforce it. I can ask Sue to go back through the special orders and check the stock, but I wouldn't hold my breath on names if I were you. If they paid cash,
I need you to do it now.
He pulled a pen from behind his ear and tossed it on the counter in defeat. All right.
One other question. Do you remember Jacob or George coming in to buy flies?
He crossed his arms and exhaled a long, slow hiss. Maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks ago?
Anybody else hear when they were talking about where they were going?
It was a long shot, but I had to play it out. He shook his head. I have no idea.
Will you think about it?
Sure.
I mean, really, think about it.
Sure. Before I could get too far from the counter, he said, Nice clothes.
I stopped and looked down at my fancy duds. You help her with the sizes?
Did it all on her own. He smiled. Something, huh?
Yep.
I continued to the door and rested my hand on the brass handle. You should be proud of yourself. She's quite a catch.
Yep.
I pulled open the door and started out.
Call me.
By the time I got back to the bee, Lucian and Turk had vacated the place, and nobody was visible, not even Dorothy. I went in and sat at the corner stool next to the cash register. After a moment, a shadow cast across my plaster-covered vinyl menu. What are you having?
Anything but the usual. I closed the menu in one hand and reached it over to her. I want to apologize for being sharp with you yesterday.
She took the menu and looked at my fingers. She'd been talking to somebody because her next glance was up to my ear. Feeling experimental, are we? She reached down and threw two meat patties from a small Tupperware container onto the grill, then dropped the basket of hand-cut potatoes into the fryer. It appeared that hamburgers and French fries were not today's usual. I asked her about Lucian and Turk. She raised an eyebrow. I think you're due a formal verbal apology. Then I think the former, yet attending, sheriff intends to take a nap in the jail. Her voice softened. How's the bear? I looked up. I bet he's out of there by this afternoon. Hard to keep a good man down. I reached up to feel my ear.
You have no idea.
She slapped my hand away. Stop that! She turned back around and flipped the sizzling patties. So where are we on the case?
Well, I'll tell you, Inspector Lestrade.
And I did. I left out any suspicions I had about Jim Keller, but that was about all.
I was looking defeat squarely in the face, and pretty soon the county would be crawling with DCI investigators and feds. I honestly didn't think they were going to get any further than I had. Nonetheless, I told her I was considering a career in telemarketing.
She filled a glass with ice and then with tea from a pitcher that sat on the cutting board. You can make a lot of money. She flipped a couple of slices of cheese onto the burgers, prepared the buns for reception on an oval-shaped plate, and pulled the fresh basket of fries from the deep fryer, hooking them on the rack to drip dry. My stomach gurgled in response to all the activity, and I was glad she had put on two cheeseburgers.
Okay, unlucky at cards.
I took a long sip of the tea. Don't even ask. She scooped up the patties, scooting them expertly onto the bun beds, and covered the rest of the plate with French fries.
That bad.
She slid the dish in front of me.
Careful, hot.
You know, I used to think I was pretty good at this relationship stuff. She wiped her hands on her apron.
Oh, Walter.
She shook her head.
You know, she's had a rough life.
Yep, I know. She's having a rough time buying the White Mountains in Arizona right now. The food, as always, tasted marvelous. Maybe when I was unemployed, I could work part-time for Dorothy. She was still looking at me, and I had the feeling I was going to have to go seek employment elsewhere.
What? When her father killed himself.
She had placed the pitcher on the counter, anticipating another fill.
There were some things going on out there.
The hazel eyes stayed steady under a salt and pepper lock.
What's that supposed to mean?
She shrugged.
Just talk. I don't think her marriage was very happy either. She looked down at my rapidly vanishing meal. How's the food? I stopped chewing long enough to reply, Marry me? That good, huh?
I looked up to check, but there wasn't a cloud in the sky. The wind was still kicking up, so I figured the snowflakes that kept waltzing around my head must have just hitched a ride. Their changing patterns reminded me of the mountain in an unsettling fashion. I thought about the visions I had been having and chalked them up to strain and just plain fatigue. Turk was sitting in one of the reception chairs and stood when I came in. Ruby was seated at her desk with her lunch of a watercress sandwich on low-fat, seven-grain bread, carrots, and a sliced apple unfolded before her, which looked fresh, healthy, and completely unappetizing. What's up? He glanced over at Ruby, who was watching him.
Could I speak with you, Sheriff?
His voice was still nasal, with the muffling of the packing and bandages. Yeah, sure, you want to talk in my office? He nodded and followed me in. I sat at my desk and gestured for him to have a seat. He shook his head and continued standing. He looked like nine kinds of hell. The bruising around his eyes had spread as far back as his sideburns, and it hurt to look at him. What can I do for you?
Uncle Lucian says this is a bad time to have this conversation with you, but I thought you ought to know about my intentions. I put my application in with the highway patrol.
I had to laugh. I couldn't even keep a hold of Turk. Really?
Yes, sir.
He twitched his face to stop an itch I was sure he was going to have for a while.
Uncle Lucian said it might be for the best.
I nodded and crossed my arms. He's a smart fellow, that one-legged bandit uncle of yours.
Yes, sir.
He looked back up at me.
He also said that if I ever ran for sheriff, you'd just run against me, win, and serve a half a term, and then step down, giving her 2 years to prove herself.
He's right, I would. Pretty soon I'd be running the place by myself. He say anything else? I thought I saw just a glimmer of a smile at the corner of his mouth, from underneath the droop of his mustache, but with the bandages it was hard to tell.
He said that masturbation is a wonderful form of stress relief in the workplace, and that the wildflowers are beautiful along I-80 in the spring.
I stuck a peeling hand out to him. He looked at it, then to me. I'm sure we were a handsome pair, him with his nose and me with my hands and ear. I won't give you a bad letter of recommendation. He took my hand, hesitantly.
Thanks.
I knew the colonel down in Cheyenne, and he owed me a few favors. I'll make some phone calls. He shook my hand a little more and then released it.
You really do want to get rid of me?
Let's just say I think it might be a better fit. I really did. The narrower limitations of vehicular law enforcement, along with a more regimented style of department, could be just what Turk needed. That, or the colonel would never owe me another favor for as long as the state had paved roads. I looked past him and saw Vic appear in the doorway. She glanced at Turk when he turned to see what I was looking at.
Jesus, you look like shit.
He turned back to me before he left.
Good luck.
I had no idea he had a sense of humor. I could have asked him about his 4570, but it didn't seem pertinent. It wasn't him, and it wasn't going to be. Vic sat in the chair opposite me, propping her feet onto my desk, as usual, and arranging a sheaf of papers in her lap. I sat back down.
Don't play with your ear.
Sorry. I returned my hand to my lap. Henry and Lucian are going even money on whether I'll lose it. Ballistics? She shuffled the papers.
Both lads match, which doesn't come as a great surprise. Both contain the same chemical compound, and both are from the same slug batch, 30-1 ratio. Same shooter.
How are your friends back in Washington?
She looked at me for a moment. Quantico.
Whatever. I pulled out a pen, uncapped it, and underlined Jim Keller's name.
I've always wondered why they haven't tried to lure you back.
There's an opening with the National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crimes Services in the Criminal Investigative Analysis Unit.
I nodded. Do you have to say all that every time you answer the phone?
There's also an opening in West Virginia at the FBI Fingerprint Analysis Lab, and there's always Philadelphia.
I exhaled slowly. Well, I didn't think we were going to be able to keep you forever.
She looked up from the papers and returned to them, and it was very quiet for a while. We ran a check on Roger Russell's gun.
I didn't even know you had it.
She looked back up, allowing her head to drop to one side in dismissal. Somebody's got to run the place while you're out traipsing around in the woods.
And?
Doesn't match. And we got a call back from the Buffalo Bill Museum. They did acquire a Sharps 4570 from Artie Smallsong more than a year ago.
I shrugged. Artie has also been locked up in the Yellowstone County Jail since Saturday.
She made a big show of pulling a pencil from behind her ear and scratching through his name on her papers. Jim Keller?
Nothing.
I put the cap back on the pen and tossed it onto the blotter.
Which brings us to the Cheyenne Rifle of the Dead.
She looked at her notes. No match, but it's been fired numerous times, like a box of shells.
20 rounds? She nodded her head. When?
Just over a week ago.
Right before the murders?
Have you ever looked down the barrel of one of those things after they've been shot?
I thought back to Omar's. Yep, once.
They let up real bad. You throw 20 rounds through one of those things without cleaning it, you're looking to get it blown up in your face.
Her hands rested on her lap.
I looked down the barrel, and you could hardly see daylight.
My ear itched, but I figured it was a good sign. So why would somebody do that?
Practice?
We looked at each other.
That lets your friend Henry off. He doesn't need practice.
I leaned back in my chair. When we were up on the mountain, he took the shotgun and gave me the rifle. He said something about not being as good a shot as me. I stood up. I better go get that damn thing out of my truck and bring it in here. It turns up missing, I'm going to be even more cursed than I am now.
It's still in your truck?
I started around the desk and looked down at the top of her head as she studied her notes. I forgot about it. She shook her head, and I reached over and touched her shoulder. By the way, thanks for the shells.
What the fuck are you talking about?
That old box of shells in my truck. The ones that look about 150 years old. She didn't move, but the tarnished gold came up slow. Please tell me you left an aged box of 4570 ammunition on the seat of my truck. I waited. Next to the rifle? She didn't say anything. Just sat there looking at me. I think she was checking to see if I was really there. I wasn't sure myself. Chapter 15. When we got to the truck, I was relieved to look through the passenger side window and see the cartridge box there. I was beginning to think that I was having some sort of mental breakdown and that the box lying beside the rifle on my seat was another phantom apparition. Do you see that box on the seat?
She peeked past my shoulder and turned her face to look at me. What box?
I nodded my head ever so slightly. Very funny. I unlocked the door and opened it. The barrel of the Cheyenne Rifle of the Dead was pointed directly at us. The box was on the seat in the exact spot where I had placed it after my brief examination. Using the inside liner of the pocket of my jacket, I reached in and showed it to Vic. Was this in here when you put the rifle on the seat and locked the truck?
No.
I looked at the box. Anybody drive my truck while I was gone?
Nobody. Did you leave your keys?
On the rack, in case somebody had to move it.
This is getting exciting.
I placed a small cardboard container on my desk along with the rifle and sat in my chair as Vic leaned against the desk with her thighs flattened on the edge and her arms crossed.
We were both looking at the damn thing like it might jump up, do backflips, and run away. It was a battered little box with the corners dented in and the edges fuzzy. The black printing was faded and scuffed, but you could still make it out. The print was in assorted fonts and at least as ornate as the handwritten edition. There was a floral pattern and a series of lines on each side that encapsulated the words, "This box contains 20 metallic cartridges manufactured by Sharps Rifle Manufacturing Company, Hartford, Connecticut." There was a large hole, exactly the size of a .45 caliber, slightly low and left of center, with 400 yards scribbled in pencil beside it. The writing was old, with a flourishing hand and detailed penmanship. It looked like the writing in the old sheriff's logbook. There was something familiar about it, and if the distance was true, it was scary shooting. When I looked up again, Vic was staring at me.
"Well, are we waiting till Christmas?"
I took two pens from my broken Denver Broncos mug and carefully held the box down with one and worked the flap open with the other. No sense in getting even more fingerprints on the thing. I slumped a little and rested my chin on my arm as I continued to look in the box. "If you were cartridges over 100 years old, wouldn't you be tarnished?"
"Yes."
"They're not." She leaned around the corner and peered into the box like something might come out.
"Looked like they were loaded yesterday."
I flattened one of the pens on the cardboard divider and slowly coaxed the box back, allowing two of the cartridges to roll out onto the blotter. They were both empties that had been fired. I spun one of the cartridges around with the pen so I could see the indentation at the primer. I turned the other one, and it was identical. Two down. I pinned the divider to the blotter again and nudged the box back, allowing two more shells to roll out. These were live, with lead and primers intact, as were those in the rest of the box. "Does it worry you that there are two of these shells spent?"
"You mean how it matches up with our current body count?"
"Something like that." I looked along the shiny lines of reflection on the surface of the casing nearest me and clearly made out discolored spots whirling in the pattern of fingerprints. Whoever had handled these cartridges had not done it with any great care, and as I glanced at the other shells, I began to see more prints. With my luck, the individual who made them had been dead for 70 years. "Do you still have that shell of Omar's that I gave you?"
"Yeah."
She retreated into her office and returned with the cartridge. While she was gone, I flipped the box over. On the other side was another hole where the shot had passed through. Impressive to the point of being mythic. I looked at the handwriting and was sure I had seen it before. When she returned and handed Omar's bullet to me, she leaned over to peruse the shells on the blotter.
"These are different."
His shell had a rounded line at the butt end that ended with two small stars and writing on the other side of the primer that read 4570, Government. On the mystery shells, there was nothing. The edges at the butt plate weren't as sharp either, as if the machining had been done in a hurry with devices under pressure to produce in difficult times. I scooped up one of the spent shells at the open end with the tip of the pen and held it up to my nose and sniffed. There was no quartzite, but traces of black powder were evident. "They are originals." I wasn't surprised when the baritone rumble of his voice interrupted our conversation. I had seen Henry walk up and lean against the doorway, but Vic hadn't, and it was just a tiny bit amusing when her back stiffened. "What are you doing out of the hospital?" He crossed over and eased himself into the chair opposite my desk. "I see you still have your ear." I laid the cartridge down on the blotter and tossed the pen back in the mug. "Yep, I've removed all the scissors from the office, and I'm just not going to take any naps when Lucian's around." I nodded toward the scattered shells on my desk. "What do you know about these?" Vic refolded her arms and looked at him, and her glance seemed to carry a little more professional interest than I would have found comforting. Henry simply smiled at her. "Hi." She smiled back.
"Hi."
I looked at the two of them for a moment. "Okay, before the two of you get into a pissing contest, how about you tell me what you know about these?" His eyes continued smiling at Vic for longer than they should have. Then he turned to me.
Where did you get them?
They were on the seat of my locked truck this morning, alongside the rifle.
Interesting.
He waited a moment.
They are originals.
How do you know that?
I am the one who polished and reloaded them, but I did not reload them for myself.
He took a deep breath and exhaled it slowly as he turned his head toward the window.
Lonnie.
After looking up at Vic, I turned back to him and waited.
Lonnie said that he wanted to shoot the rifle, and I was concerned that he might run some of those hot, modern cowboy loads through it. I took 40 of the original cartridges he had and hand-loaded them so they wouldn't damage the rifle. I sighed and raised my eyes up to Vic.
Get a preliminary on these shells, then ship samples down to DCI. She nodded, and I stood.
How far do you think you can get within our obvious technical limitations?
Pretty damn far.
She looked at me as I scooped up the rifle.
Where are you going?
I glanced over at Henry, who was studying me.
I'm going out to talk with Lonnie Littlebird and get some fingerprints.
You sure you don't want somebody to go with you?
I looked back at him.
I got somebody.
The heat of the day had begun to melt away what remained of the snow, and the clouds were just beginning to break up in the face of a mild Wyoming autumn afternoon. As we drove out of town, I looked in the rearview mirror at the bighorns. The fresh coat of snow had done them some good, even if it hadn't done either of us any. We rode along in silence. My sheepskin jacket was draped over Henry's shoulders. Dina Manycamps had forgotten to bring him a coat along with his fresh clothes. He didn't particularly look irritated, just preoccupied, so I left him alone with his thoughts. I had picked up a fingerprint kit from our mini-lab and informed Ruby where we were going, asking her to relay any information gotten from Dave at the sports shop, from the Espers, or Jim Keller. Lucian was still in the back asleep, and I told her to wake him up if anything happened. She had looked at me and withheld comment. There was one question on my mind, and it concerned a box of aged 45-70 shells that had been left on my truck seat. I broke the silence by asking,
"Why did he leave them?"
"I do not know."
He didn't turn, but slouched a little against the door, the Cheyenne rifle of the dead leaning gently against the inside of one of his knees.
"Unless it was good fortune."
"For whom?"
"You."
He still looked out the windshield at the sunny afternoon.
"Lonnie has grown very fond of you over the last few years. The last time we were there, he asked me if it would be all right if he gave this rifle to you."
"The Cheyenne rifle of the dead? Thanks a lot, but no thanks." He rode along quietly, and I was pretty sure I had hurt his feelings. "If it's all the same with you and Lonnie, I think I'll just hang around here in the camp of the living for a while."
"That is not why he wanted to give it to you."
He turned and looked at me for the first time.
"He wanted to give it to you to shield you."
"From what?" He shrugged and looked back out the windshield.
"He said that you need protection from something very powerful and very bad."
The rest he spoke in a monotone.
"He said that you are a good man, and that there are those who would assist you if they could, that they had spoken with him, and that if you would allow them, they would help you."
"Help me what?" He sat there for a while, and I was getting worried that he might have left the hospital a little prematurely when he spoke.
"Live."
As we passed the cutoff to the Powder River Road, I thought about what Vani had said, that she had assembled herself so that she didn't have to deal with all the things I had suddenly reintroduced into her life. I thought about caring about somebody more than life itself. As I looked back, I was pretty sure that Martha hadn't loved me that much.
She'd been fond of me, but had settled for me and had made the best of her situation. She had stayed because of Katie, and I had stayed because I loved Katie that much. I simply couldn't conceive of doing anything else. I figured what I'd do was go over to Vonnie's tonight and have a long talk with her. Maybe we could put things off until this case was over. The time when I had held her long toes, fitting the high arches of her feet in the palms of my hands, and had driven her home in the dark of the night, seemed very far away and receding. Henry dozed as I drove away from the sun, and the ruffling of his breath became steadier as we took the cutoff to the reservation. I saw Brandon White Buffalo looking after us as we went through the intersection. He stood behind his counter. It was hard to miss him as he looked through the clinging soda, chips, and candy advertisements. I extended a hand across the cab toward him, and he watched as we passed without slowing. He raised his hand also and pressed it against the heavy double glass of the convenience store window. Brandon White Buffalo stood there in the maelstrom of modern consumerism like a sentinel, like a warning in a mystical undertow. I looked back through the rear window of the truck to catch a last glance. He still stood there, palm out and fingers spread like an orchard basket against the glass. He looked after us until we were gone, and I thought of Melissa at the Little Bighorn. I reset my shoulders, concentrated on the road, and considered my dwindling staff. Turk would be out by January. Vic could possibly be gone before that, and the chances of me getting Ferg to return to full duty were slim. He would probably just retire. I was thinking about it myself. I picked the mic off the dash. "Base, this is Unit 1. Come in." After a moment there was static, then Ruby's voice. "Leave me alone. I'm busy." "Any word from Dave at the sports shop?" Static. "His wife called. She's about halfway through and will fax the stuff over when she gets done. Stop bothering me." I hung the mic back up and watched the trees pass by along the irrigation ditch. I expected to see the old Cheyenne again, standing among the cottonwoods. But there was nothing there, and that worried me a little more. Maybe even they had abandoned me. I thought about where we were going, about Lonnie. Yes, and his soul. I didn't think that Lonnie had killed Cody and Jacob, but I wanted to talk to him directly and find out if there was anything more to his story than Henry had been able to tell me. I looked over at my friend. It seemed that his breathing had gotten a little rougher, but he still slept, his body attempting to repair itself while he wasn't looking. There was a maroon minivan with a bumper sticker that read "Fry Bread Power" in Lonnie's driveway, and there was someone sitting on the passenger side. Even from the distance and angle, I knew it was Melissa. I brought the bullet to a stop alongside the van. Henry woke and placed a hand on the dash to steady himself. "You all right?"
"Yes."
He blinked, "just sleepy." He looked out the passenger side at the bullet, and I saw the muscles at the side of his face bunch as he smiled at her. His hand came up to the glass, and I knew hers was extended toward him. He handed me the rifle. I took a moment to collect myself, giving them enough time to be together before I opened my own door and came around the back of the truck. It was a moment I had avoided, this personal contact. But here she was, and here I was with her. She was holding him, and I was amazed at how she had grown. Melissa was taller, still lean, but muscled now, and even though she hadn't lost all of the stunting qualities of fetal alcohol syndrome, the graceful quality that was indicative of the Cheyenne and their personal beauty was there. Her face turned to me. I hadn't seen that face, with the exception of that fleeting glance at the powwow, for more than 3 years. Her eyebrows still arched in a questioning fragility, and the folds at the insides of her eyes still attempted to betray her. In honor of the golden fall afternoon, and despite the oncoming winter, she was dressed in a pair of gray flannel athletic shorts and a T-shirt that read, "Sweet Medicine Treatment Center, Sobriety Retreat." I stood there for a moment with a rifle in my hand, unable to move, as she loosened herself from Henry only long enough to attach herself to me. I held the rifle out so that it could not touch her, and looped my other arm around her shoulders. Henry quietly took the gun. After a moment, she pulled back to look up at me.
"You are sad?"
I laughed as a tear threatened to escape the corner of my eye. "I guess I'm just happy to see you." She smiled back, and it was like sunshine through a church window.
"I'm happy to see you, too."
Henry retreated and headed up to the house with the Sharps as Melissa and I talked. She kept a hand on my arm as we spoke, as if the connection might be fleeting and neither of us could take the chance. She'd received a partial basketball scholarship to a community college in South Dakota and was only back from her special classes for a tournament. She wanted to know if I could come home with her in a week and a half and spend Thanksgiving with her and her aunts. She assured me that Lonnie would be there, too. I asked her where Lonnie was now.
"He's inside, arguing with my Aunt Arbutus. She said that I should come out and sit in the car. I'm glad you are here. I was bored."
As she spoke, I became aware of a commotion. The screen slapped open, and the most formidable of the aunts made her way from the porch and headed toward us. Henry was wheeling Lonnie out the door after her, with the buffalo rifle in Lonnie's lap, along with a small black plastic box. Melissa's aunt pulled up short when she saw me. I hadn't formally met Arbutus Little Bird and had previously withstood her cast-iron gaze from afar. She didn't like me, but I think it was less because I was a white man with a badge and more because I associated with Henry. "Aye, Arbutus." She redirected her gaze at Melissa.
"Get in the car."
I took a deep breath and took Melissa's hand in mine. She was trembling. "Arbutus, do you want to tell me what's going on?" She didn't respond, but stood there with her hands at her sides as Henry wheeled Lonnie up behind her. She turned slightly and spat out the words,
"I hope you're happy now that the sheriff's here."
Lonnie's eyes did light up when he saw me.
"Hello, Sheriff."
"Hey, Lonnie. What's going on?"
"Oh, my sister isn't going to let me have my daughter for the holidays. Yes, it is so."
I glanced up at Henry, who shrugged. I looked back at the galvanized aunt. "What's the story?"
"I'm taking her home."
"Well, do you mind telling me why it is you're not going to let her have Thanksgiving with her father?" A moment passed.
"I don't have to talk to you."
"No, you don't. But I can get on the radio and get one of the IPs over here and you can talk to him." I was playing an angle, but most inhabitants of the reservation hated Indian police even more than us. We were just whites. They were apples. Red on the outside, white on the inside. She didn't say anything. "Whatever it is, I'm sure we can work it out."
"I found a beer in his refrigerator."
I turned and looked at Lonnie. "Is that true, Lonnie?" God, like I didn't know the response.
"Yes, it is true. Yes, it is so."
He continued to smile.
"I keep it there as a reminder, and to keep temptation at hand. Temptation out of reach does you no good."
"How long has the beer been in there?"
"About a year and a half."
She crossed her arms, but she turned to look down at him. We were making progress.
"How come I haven't seen it in there before?"
He blinked his eyes through the thick glasses.
"It was behind the pickled pig's feet. You don't ever move them."
"Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is so."
The look on her face told me he was telling the truth. "Arbutus, do you think it would be all right if Lonnie came over for Thanksgiving dinner at your place?" I waited a moment myself for the next one. "And do you think it would be all right if Melissa came over here and spent the night with Lonnie, maybe on the Friday after Thanksgiving?" She didn't say anything, but turned to look at me.
Friday night, then?
Get in the car, Melissa.
She started to open the door, but Melissa's voice stopped her.
Would it be okay if the sheriff came over for Thanksgiving dinner, too?
Arbutus stopped and turned to look at her, then at me. She was a hard old gunboat, but I saw the steely eyes soften a little.
Walter is always welcome at our table.
She started to open the door, but her eyes steered clear of mine.
You know where I live. Melissa, will you get in the car?
The hand loosened in mine, and she leaned in to give a slight peck on my lowered cheek.
I'll see you in a couple of weeks.
I'll do my best. She stopped. I'll be there. The smile returned, and I watched as she turned the corner and got into the van, or almost did, before she jumped out, ran around the front, and gave her father and uncle a goodbye hug. I leaned against the bed of my truck, crossed my arms, and looked down. How you doing, Lonnie?
I'm good. And how are you?
I'm all right. Did you leave me a little present? He looked up at Henry through the split lenses, and the mid-afternoon sun glinted off his metal-framed glasses. Then he turned back to me and smiled.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did.
I nodded. How did you get in my truck?
Oh, those new ones are easy to break into. That and the keys by the door of your office.
Yes, it is so. I had to relocate the key rack. Why did you leave the ammo for me?
You're gonna think I'm crazy if I tell you.
The smile was a little weak when he looked up. Lonnie, I've seen an awful lot of crazy stuff lately. So why don't you try me?
The old ones told me you would need them.
He nodded.
Yes. When I lost my legs, they began talking to me. I think it is because my legs are with them now. They tell me half things.
Half things?
Yes, because I am only half with them.
Someday all of me will be with them,
and they will tell me everything.
I smiled. I hope you don't get the whole story too soon, Lonnie. I looked down at the rifle in his lap. Lonnie, did you take the gun out and shoot it a bunch of times? He looked genuinely ashamed.
I was angry. So I shot one of the fence posts out back.
I thought of the things I might shoot if somebody had done to my daughter what had been done to his. The image of Lonnie out on his back porch late one night, shooting at a singular fence post, hung there just out of range. I'm pretty sure I jumped a little when the radio crackled in the truck. I could hear Ruby's voice through the glass and the transceived miles.
Come in, Unit 1.
It was probably word from the sports shop or on the Espers, but when I looked up at the clock on the dash, it was only 2:30. Maybe it was Jim Keller. I opened the door and keyed the mic.
Base, this is Unit 1. Go ahead.
Static.
Walt? George Esper is gone again.
I slumped against the door jamb of the truck and rested my head on the mic in my hand.
You've got to be kidding.
Static.
He stole Ferg's truck. Vixen pursuit.
Where?
Static.
Out 16. Probably on the highway. He already ran into somebody near the co-op. Turk's out there now.
Did anybody notify the HPs?
Static.
Yes.
I waited a moment. Chances are Vic was still in range.
Static, then a fainter signal broke through.
I'm at mile marker 113, and if the little fucker was up here, I would have caught him by now.
Vic, leave the highway to the HPs. I got a sneaking suspicion that he's headed out this way.
Static. And I listened as she slowed the 5-year-old unit down to under 100, negotiating the divider with one hand.
I'm on my way back, but if that's the case, he's got a hell of a lead on me.
We'll get in from the other direction. Unit 1 out. I hung the mic back up and leaned out to look at Henry. "You coming?" He nodded and started pulling Lonnie back up to the house. Lonnie grabbed the wheel rails of his chair and slid himself to a stop.
"You go ahead. I can get back in the house myself. Yes, it is so."
Then he reached down and handed the rifle up to me.
"Take this."
I took the rifle as he handed the black plastic box to Henry. Henry looked at him, nodded, and came around to the passenger door. As I crossed in front of the truck, I stopped.
"Lonnie, you know that cartridge box?"
He continued to smile.
"Yes."
"It has writing on it, next to the bullet hole."
He nodded and smiled.
"Whose handwriting is that?"
"You should know that handwriting."
"Lonnie, I don't have a lot of time."
"Ne don nestigo. He who sheds his leg."
Lucian.
"He used to shoot with us out at the Buffalo Wallows back in the day. One time my father challenged him to try to hit a target as small as the cartridge box at 400 yards, and he did it."
"Yes, it is so." It took me a minute to get myself going. "Thanks, Lonnie." I climbed in the truck and, reaching for my seatbelt, motioned Henry to do the same. He placed the small black plastic case at his feet and held the rifle as easily in his hands as he had held the one in Omar's helicopter. By the time we got to the end of the state route that joined with the main drag, we were doing about 100 with the sirens and lights at full tilt. It was still going to take us more than 20 minutes to get back to the other side of the reservation, and my knuckles tightened around the wheel. I concentrated on the road as we passed the cutoff down to the Powder River. "I think he's headed toward us."
"Because of what he said at the hospital about living on the res."
"It's as good a guess as any."
He braced a hand against the dash as the gravitational pull of a sweeping turn almost slid us into the barrow ditch.
"What did Lonnie say about the writing on the box?"
"He said it was Lucian's."
"You never heard that?"
"I never asked."
"I guess it was done a long time ago when Lucian was shooting with Lonnie's father." At the next straightaway, he opened what looked like a cleaning kit and pulled out two long stems and began threading them together. "What are you doing?"
"I am cleaning this rifle."
"That's evidence."
"No, it is a weapon."
It took a while, even at our speed, but we finally made it to the northern end of the Powder when another vehicle popped over the horizon that was traveling at a pretty good speed of its own. From the distance, it was hard to tell who it was, but after a moment, I could see the lights. I grabbed the mic.
"Vic, is that you?"
"Static."
"Fuck yes, it's me. Where in the hell did that little shit go?"
I slowed and stopped. By the time I had, she was pulling up alongside us and was rolling down her window. She had to crank. I cut the siren and she leaned an elbow on the sill.
"What now?"
I thought. "Well, if he didn't take 14 back toward Sheridan, the only other main road is Powder River back here."
"North or south?"
"We'll take south, you take north." She was gone in a billowing cloud of blue burned oil and tire smoke before I could finish my sentence. Maybe if I bought her a new unit. I turned the bullet around and laid a little strip of my own, accelerating back to the Powder. When we got to the cutoff, the only thing headed north was a drifting cloud of dirt that hazed the gravel road into the distance. We made the turn and headed south as the back end of the bullet attempted to get ahead of us. I countersteered and hit the gas again as we slid around the first turn just about sideways and clipped a few mailboxes. I noticed Henry struggling to hold on to the sharps and find his seatbelt with one hand.
"What's the matter?"
"Just buckling up. It's the law."
This was the first time I had taken the big beast up to speed for any length of time. There hadn't been any reason before. It was heavy, but I was surprised by the agility it had.
"All right, you can crash now."
He had gotten his seatbelt on and was studying the road farther ahead as I dealt with the ground at hand.
"I see dust."
If it was George, he had just jumped off the highway. A thought snagged in my mind.
"Do you think he's got the radio on in that thing?"
Henry turned to look at me as I negotiated another turn and another quickly afterward.
That would explain why he got off the state routes.
There's something else.
What?
The old Esper place is out here somewhere, the one that Reggie's great-great-grandfather settled. I remember Vonnie telling me about it. She bought a bunch of property on a speculation that they were going to put that power plant out there someday.
How does romance bloom?
Don't ask. I could feel his disapproving glance as we crossed a cattle guard and momentarily became airborne. We made for the washboard curve that lay ahead, and he braced himself.
Hey, I thought you guys always thought it was a good day to die. Attributed to Crazy Horse, who was often misquoted.
The road straightened after the washboard, and I was able to bring all 10 cylinders online. The speedometer was creeping back up on 80, and we were starting to get that light, floating feeling on the ball bearings of loosely packed dirt. My testicles felt as if they were somewhere in my chest cavity, and it wasn't a pleasant feeling. If we missed one of the curves at this speed, we were most assuredly dead. All Henry said was, "Ooh, shit." We hit the next turn at just about 100, and the sickening feeling in my stomach magnified as the laws of geometry exerted themselves on the velocity of all that Dearborn steel. At any reasonable speed, it wasn't much of a turn, certainly nothing worthy of a Jan and Dean ballad, but it was enough to slam the side of the truck into the red clay embankment. When we bounced off the wall, I overcorrected, and the bullet shot for the river. I turned ever so slightly, trying to urge our velocity forward, and only the left rear wheel slipped off the road. The truck tipped slightly back to center, where we gained purchase and shot into the next straightaway. He looked over at me, the passenger side mirror beating against his door.
"You want a wreck? Do your side, okay?"
George had obviously had a little trouble getting around that one, too. His side view mirror bounced and clattered under the bullet. We had gained a good amount on him. When we saw him next, he had topped a hill and was bouncing immediately through another cattle guard that was on his right. The road continued a steady climb until we got to where he had been, and I slowed just a little because there might be a slope on the other side. It was a good thing I had, because the road did make a sharp cut to the right, and there was a reasonable drop-off. George had not made it. You could see where the Toyota had gone through the fence sideways, taking the majority of the barbed wire and aged posts with it. The little truck had most certainly gone over, but it had landed on its wheels, and George was still bumping his way across the bottomland where the pasture ended in a gate only about a quarter of a mile ahead. If we kept our speed up, we would get there before him and arrive in a large wash that opened to the east with a rise of about 8 feet in more than a mile. This was the part of the river that admitted honestly to the moniker a mile wide and an inch deep. There wasn't much in that direction other than the access road to the Burlington Northern Santa Fe tracks. There wasn't anywhere else for him to go. He couldn't turn back and try to climb the hill he had just slid down, and the river blocked him to the left where the water might only be an inch deep, but the mud was bottomless. He had to go for the gate, and we were going to be there before him. I slowed just a little, since time and topography were now on our side. The Toyota leaped in and out of the hillocks and sagebrush. You could see him in there sawing at the wheel in an attempt to keep the pickup on a relatively straight line, his head beating against the headliner as he topped each rise. I cringed a little at the thought of what he was doing to his leg, his jaw, and other assorted and sundry injuries. We made the last turn before the gate, and I accelerated briefly before sliding to a stop and blocking his path. I figured the faster I got there, the sooner he might pull the battered little Toyota to a stop. But he kept coming, and I was beginning to wonder if he could see us or if he had beaten himself senseless. I waited as he approached, and it was only when he was about 70 feet from the gate that I saw the wheels turn and the vehicle lurch down the hill. George had decided to test the waters.
"Jesus H. Christ!"
I gunned the bullet farther down the fence line till I found a likely spot and cut the wheel myself, this time pulling a couple of yards of barbed wire and stapled posts after me. We followed him to the cut bank of the river and watched as the underside of his truck suddenly became visible. The jump didn't get very far and, as anticipated, the wheels and most of the front of the Toyota sank into the soft mud of the Powder River, effectively ending the vehicular portion of George's getaway. I pulled up sideways and watched in absolute exhaustion
as George climbed out of the window of his truck, fell into the water, rose up, and began quick-slogging away from us as fast as his bandaged leg would carry him. I looked past Henry in disbelief as he turned to hand me the rifle.
"If you do not shoot him, I will.
We don't have any bullets, or I would seriously consider it." He laughed and pulled a gleaming .45-70 from his shirt pocket and held it up. "Where did you get that?"
"Off your desk. Where do you think?"
I pulled the handle and opened my door. "We're trying to keep somebody from shooting him." He started out on the other side.
"I am beginning to question the logic in that."
George had gotten a good start, but his injury and the mud were slowing him quite a bit, and I could see the gray slime of the riverbed clinging to his pants well above his knees. I stopped at the cut and stood at the edge. He was about 50 yards out. I cupped my hands around my mouth and yelled, "George, where do you think you're going?" Henry joined me at the dark crust edge of the bank. He was still carrying the rifle.
"If you shoot him now, we do not have to bury him."
I cupped my hands around my mouth again.
"George, that's enough. Get back over here."
George continued on. I started down the bank and slipped, barely catching myself before I fell into the river. I looked down into water that I was sure was just above freezing and tried to figure out what the best approach might be. I was never an all-at-once guy, preferring to ease myself into things, but I was about ready to throw prudence to the wind when Henry spoke. The tone of his voice ran a chill colder than the powder had ever run.
"Walt, there's somebody over there."
I raised my head and searched the opposite bank, but all I could see was George slowly making his way across.
"Where?"
"Long way out. See that pointed clump of sage to George's right? Just to the right of that, all the way out at the horizon." I stopped breathing, strained my eyes, and there it was, a small, vertical figure in a horizontal landscape. "You sure that's not a pronghorn or a mule deer?"
"No. It is a man, and he is armed."
As Henry spoke, a small burst of smoke erupted from the figure. Just over 2 seconds later, George was cartwheeled backward into the frigid water. I took an involuntary step forward and splashed into the river water as George hit the mud. He struggled to get up, rolling himself sideways as he attempted to sit. It was a slow, grinding motion before things slipped into the adrenaline-induced rate where the real world cannot keep pace. I yelled with everything I had, "Stay down!" He couldn't hear, or it didn't matter. I had seen it in Vietnam, and I had seen it here. When you are a standing animal and you suddenly discover that you are not, there is an overriding need to rise and prove to yourself that you are intact.
"Reloading."
When I turned, he had already thrown me the rifle. I caught it and quickly jacked the lever down and extended a hand up for the shell as he fished in his shirt pocket. At that point, all I could think of was the penny he had tossed to me at the bar that night. He threw me the round. It hit the side of my palm and started to ricochet off, but I caught it against my chest and quickly inserted it past the dropped block and brought the lever up. I squared myself for the shot, and my shoulder jarred as the stock came up and slammed against it. I had to calm down and bring it all together in a fluid motion. That's when it occurred to me to breathe. I filled my chest cavity and felt the burn of flooding oxygen as I flipped up the vernier sight. 675.
700 if it's an inch.
Damn it! I readjusted as quickly as I could. Where's Omar when you need him? Henry laughed as I brought the rifle up again, and it was just what I needed. All the tension faded from me. I pulled the set trigger and paused for a moment to check my target. Even at this distance, there was something familiar, something I knew, someone I knew. I adjusted my figures to encompass the season, general elevation of the shooter, and mean temperature. An approximation of 1/2100ths of an inch was the starting point, but I would have to go higher with current conditions. I peered through the pinhole of the vernier's tiny disc, which was capable of measurements as small as 1/1000th of an inch, and through the knife-shaped German silver blade sight. He was waiting for me there, whoever he was. A mirror image at 700 yards with the same offhand positioning.
It occurred to me that the first one of us to find something to rest against might be the one who would still be standing. But there was no time. I had an ace in the hole because I wasn't the one he was shooting at least as far as I knew. I considered how many unfortunate individuals had held that as a last thought. George was clearly in my peripheral vision as I closed my left eye and blocked out the sight of the suffering youth. He had struggled up into a sitting position and now cradled his right arm in his left. It was difficult to tell what was blood and what was darkened from the water. I could hear him sobbing and only hoped it would continue. I allowed my breath to slowly drift out with the faint breeze, and it blended with the rounded river stones, the rustling of the dying buffalo grass, and with the faint wisps of high-altitude clouds. I could hear the song I had heard before on the mountain, the one that had shaken the trees and resonated through rock. The old Cheyenne were there now with me, and I could hear their voices ascending as I held their rifle. I pulled the trigger of the big sharps, and they whistled across the Powder River and beyond with a deadly accuracy that begged forgiveness as they went. They imparted death as a release and an involuntary shudder in the ongoing action of things. I hardly felt the kick and lowered the rifle in acceptance of a foregone conclusion. The figure dropped, and I listened as his wayward shot passed just above our heads. It screamed like misplaced vengeance and slapped through both sides of the bullet's double-sided bed. George continued to sob, and I was glad that